So the way the Q&A is going to work, Ashley has a microphone in the center aisle up there. If you have a question, you can head to the center aisle. We can form a small line. You can ask your question. I will record the Q&A as well for the podcast, so please speak into the microphone. You can speak loudly, too. It's not a very powerful microphone. But that helps everybody to hear, and so we can get it on the recording. And then you'll get your answer. If you can't leave your seat or would rather Ashley bring the microphone to you, you can just wave her down, and she'll be very happy to do that as well. So with that, we'll go ahead. We'll turn the mic back over to Dr. Pollack and start the Q&A.
Please.
Thank you. Dr. Pollack, excellent presentation. Thoroughly enjoyed both parts of the presentation. Was especially interested in some of your comments about learning and the process of storytelling or how people integrate or get attached to the information and are able to retain it. I wonder if you had ever had any opportunity to look at the process that occurs when patients meet together in social media sites and work as a team to understand their own illnesses or work with caregivers or whatever who is interested in that problem happens to be on that site. The process of learning and the health literacy that's demonstrated there.
I have not done that. So the question has to do with, let me paraphrase and make sure I've got it right. Mm-hmm. For patients who work as a cohort, as a group, and go through a process to co-learn what a particular condition is about.
Yes, especially patients who have that problem or family members who, like some of you were talking about some of the transplants, some of these
right.
people. There's a commonality there of connection among the people who face those problems. I just wondered if you'd ever had a chance to analyze any of that kind of learning and what you thought of it.
Thank you for that question. I have not done that. In the process of the heart transplant study, the rest of the team did do something like that, where they took the children and they had them away for a summer camp for a week mm-hmm. and worked with the kids in that cohort, hoping that the children themselves would pose questions and the older kids who had found answers would give the younger kids some answers. But what came out of that was for the scientists, an understanding that the kids collectively still had a bunch of burning questions that they weren't getting answered. And for example, they wanted to know a lot about this biopsy. Why do we need to take a chunk of heart out of the healthy heart to look at it? And they found that really odd and they wanted to look at biopsies. So what the team did early on before I joined in is they actually brought microscopes and slides up for the kids to look at. And when they told me that, I said, that's not helpful because unless you're trained at looking at a pathological slide mm-hmm. and know what you're looking at and why you're looking at it, you look in a microscope at a high magnification, you're just going to see a bunch of blue blobs. And it was really hard for the kids to appreciate what was going on. And that's where animation helps to expand that story and bring attention to the right things. So on the one hand, I think you're absolutely right that it's going to help engage the audience. But I also would say you need a tour guide. You need somebody who has some valid, verifiable knowledge to help guide the process. And we see that a lot in group therapies for all sorts of different diseases, where there is an expert, an informed nurse practitioner, or someone who's helping to parse the information. Or as a team, if you come up with key questions, that you're then willing to take them back to the health professional to get the answers. So I think that's a ripe opportunity for further study.
Yes, I think my own experience looking at some of those, the learning is much more random because it's questionnaire
right.
questionnaire. And I think that's interesting because usually when information presented, it's presented in an organized, hierarchical kind of structure. And to see how that different way, storytelling tends to be a little more, not quite so hierarchical. It's more
right.
Integrated like that. Anyways, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Good afternoon or good evening. Thank you so much for a very informative speech. I was wondering, when you were showing the experiment with the rats and you gave the injection at that particular point, and some of them received relief where the other ones did not, how long were you able to see an improvement for the rat, or did it outlive its...
The study only went those 12 days, and that's exactly the very next question that we want to ask in more detail. How long will that single injection persist and give the relief? I don't know the answer to that yet, but we're definitely, that'll be some of the very next things that we're looking at.
Great, thank you.
Forgive me if somebody else asked this and I missed it, but if we're experiencing pain, it really matters, right? You notice that it hurts, toothache, backache, chronic pain's bad, acid reflux. But if you're not experiencing pain, that's good. But what if you had it in the past and now it's gone? Doesn't it affect your system, like, for the rest of your life? If you had, like, a really bad experience that's painful emotionally, you remember it, right? And does your body remember physical pain or any kind of pain the same way?
So pain is, let me paraphrase and react. Pain is super valuable. Pain is one of the many senses your body has. We have sight, we have hearing, we have taste, we have touch. We have all these different senses that are super important to our survival, and pain is one of them. And it just like Sandy's saying, you get something that's painful, and it's giving you some important information, like maybe you don't want to do that again. There's a consequence to that. Or, gosh, I've hurt my foot, and I need to favor it until it's healed and gets healthy again. Now the pain's gone, and I can run again and do everything normal. So it's an important bit of information. Just this morning, I was at another conference out of town, and it was looking at regenerative medicine and pain. And one of the very interesting things that came out is I showed you tonight that there's this inflammatory response. The immune cells are coming in. And as a scientist, I think those immune cells are actually providing some of the cues, the signals that are increasing the pain sensitivity, that are telling the neurons be more sensitive. What I found out today is that those immune cells can go away, that you can resolve and get healthier again and have the immune cells say, okay, we don't need the inflammation anymore, and the immune cells go away, and these cytokines and inflammatory factors, they go away. But the neuron stays super activated for a couple more weeks. And it takes a couple weeks for the neuron to settle back down and get rid of all of that pain. And that's kind of where the transition between resolving the pain, healing the wound, getting over it, and chronic pain. When chronic pain, the wound is all healed, but the pain is persisting and staying on. So the pain story ends up being very complex. A lot of the times, it is a very healthy, important part of the process. When it's out of control, that's when we need some other intervention to take care of it. Yes. So the question has to do with phantom pain. Phantom pain is a pain that happens if I've amputated a limb and my arm is gone. I might wake up one morning with my hand aching. Well, there's no hand there. And yet my brain is telling me that my hand is in excruciating pain and I can't do anything about it because it's not there. Or it might be as simple as my hand is itchy and I want to itch it and get rid of that itch, but the hand's not there so I can't itch it. So phantom pain comes in a lot of different ways. Phantom pain is, various studies have demonstrated that it's a process in our brain. Now, remember at the beginning I showed that we've got our brain, our spinal cord, and then there's the peripheral nervous system, the stuff outside that goes all the way out to our skin and our tips of our fingers and our feet. And my studies are on the peripheral nervous system. I don't do studies on the central nervous system. And I know from what I've read that a lot of the phantom pain study has to do with processes going on in the brain, that they set up sort of a feedback loop making you think that that tissue, that part of your body, is being affected. Now, excuse me. Intellectually, I think that even though I've lost my hand, the dorsal root ganglion is still intact. The part of the external outside the central nervous system part is still there. So I think that part of the phantom pain process is initiated by things that are happening in the dorsal root ganglion. But it ends up being the brain interpreting these errant signals, as I would call them, and leading you to think that you've got pain in that limb. It ends up being a very complex story. And what's going on now for a variety of studies is they found that getting people who do have phantom pain to visualize the limb, to imagine that the hand is actually there, and doing that through a variety of mental tricks or even using props gives them the opportunity to get control of the pain. Sometimes they even do it just by giving you a mirror so that you see your left hand, but you're mirror projecting it so it looks like your right hand. That there's ways of tricking your brain into thinking that that limb is there, and then you can start managing the pain. There's a fair bit of studies that are going on about that, but it ends up being certainly beyond my expertise. I should stop. Yes? So again, so the question has to do with breaking the pain cycle, that you get into pain and you're in persistent pain and the medicines that you're trying become less and less effective and the pain keeps persisting. Again, this, I'm not an expert in this, and the best I can do is tell you a story I heard this morning that relates. The story goes to bladder pain problems, severe chronic bladder pain problems. And nowadays, a lot of people are treated using opioid drugs because the pain can be so intense that that's the only way to manage it. But some recent studies have demonstrated that giving a patient a pump that's going to provide a little bit of local anesthesia, like the stuff that they would rub on your gum in your mouth before you get that injection, just a little lidocaine, having that pump squirt a little bit of lidocaine, very, very low dose, inside the bladder, is sufficient to relieve the pain. And then you can go about your day, and when the pain comes back, the pump puts a little bit of lidocaine in the bladder again, and you're managing the pain. What the studies have also demonstrated that for patients who do this, after several weeks, they find that they're not hitting the pump very much anymore. And that the idea here is that by taking away the pain, it sets up a feedback loop between the pain and the inflammation begins to resolve. And the neurons begin to go back to their normal state and aren't super sensitive. And you get to the point that you actually don't need the medicine anymore. It was actually a really interesting study that pointing that out. So I think that's one of the ways of doing that. So what it made me think is that, gosh, if we have chronic pain of a neuropathic type where you've got this nerve inflammation going on, this I've been demonstrating with my animal model, that this localized treatment that you do for a couple of weeks or a couple of months might get to the point that it resolves the pain or even prevents the chronic pain from getting worse, and then things get back to normal and you can take away the medicines altogether. So I think there's a real possibility for that in many cases. But boy, pain is complex. There's a lot of work to do. Yes?
What exactly is a pain receptor?
That's a super great question, and I feel bad that I didn't give you a better picture of that. And the next time I give this talk, I will. I actually thought about putting it in, and I didn't. A pain receptor, in the first case, I would say it's a cell. It's a particular type of cell that's going to have on its surface proteins that are going to react to pain. Now, you have neurons in your eye that are receptors that are receiving photons of light. You have hair cells in your ear that pick up the vibrations of sound. We have taste receptors or olfactory receptors in our nose that are neurons that have specialized structures on them that pick up the signal that you're perceiving. So you have this other class of cells all over the place. A lot, I talked about the skin, but you've got them on your internal viscera that tell you when your stomach is too full and you're bloated and you feel crummy. You've got them in your muscles, you've got them all over the place that are reporting when you've got some type of insult or injury. And they're specialized to react to all sorts of different types of stimulus. I use the temperature as an example because I think that's pretty familiar. You can pick up something that's too hot or pick up something that's too cold and feel the transition going from just a little bit of one temperature to something that's actually painful. Those are specialized neurons in the skin. On those neurons, you have some of these TRP proteins that are reacting to the temperature. And if they get the right type of signal, it's a protein that opens up a pore and lets calcium pour through into the cell, and that calcium is the signal that starts the neuron up and sends the signal on to the nervous system. Yes? The inflammatory response is your body's overall evolutionarily conserved mechanism to try to preserve the tissue, figure out what's going on, what happened, what's wrong, and bring as many different mechanisms to bear to resolve that insult or injury. Sometimes you can overdo it with the medicines and actually defeat the purpose of the immune system for what it's trying to do. So part of it is the balance between letting the immune system do what it's supposed to do and minimizing it so that it's not so uncomfortable that it's interfering with your overall life. Now, I talked about a neuroinflammatory pain. There's a lot of other pains that don't rely on the immune system to be brought about. So this isn't the end all of all pains. So your immune system is, it's just about as complicated as your nervous system. I think of the immune system as an organ, but it's distributed, and it's moving all the time. It's an organ that's collecting information from all sorts of different systems, and then it's making decisions about how to deal with that information. And when you have a cut, first thing that's going to happen is let's stop the bleeding, just like you learned in first aid. Stop the bleeding. So platelets come in, and they stop the bleeding. And then you're going to bring in macrophages to say, gosh, maybe that cut brought in some bacteria. So we're going to find anything that's foreign here and start eating it up and trying to take it out of action. And as that's happening, you're getting a secondary inflammatory response that's leading to swelling. You're getting more fluids around there that cause the swelling. So it's a series of steps and complex events, all of which at face value are there to manage the injury. Some of your immune system is creating inflammatory signals that are inflaming the situation. Some of your immune system is providing anti-inflammatory signals right away. So automatically your immune system is trying to balance how inflamed it should be versus how inflamed we don't want it to get. And our ibuprofen, acetaminophen, aspirin, they all work pretty much at the same level of interfering with prostaglandins, one of this molecule that leads to this overall inflammatory response, and just tones it down a little bit and manages that pain in bringing it under control. Yes? The question has to do with people who do not feel pain. Well, I'm going to answer this in two ways. There's, I heard some of these facts this morning, which helps me out a lot. I'm glad I paid attention. A study was done looking at human brain by functional magnetic resonant imaging. And people were given minor insults, minor pains. And taking away the notion of give me your 1 to 10 scale of how much does this hurt, but measuring directly in the brain how much of a response the brain was saying the body was feeling to pain. And they'd also ask the person, the test subject, give me your 1 to 10 scale of how much this actually hurt when I did something to you. And what they found is that from person to person to person to person, the brain was reporting the same scale of pain. So if I hurt somebody a lot, I got a big signal. If I hurt somebody a medium amount, I got a medium signal. If I hurt somebody a tiny bit, I got a tiny signal in the brain. That's what the fMRI was telling. But when I asked the patients to say how much did it hurt, some of the people who got the powerful pain stimulus, not so much. Some of the people who got the medium pain stimulus, oh, it was devastating. So how people were reporting the pain didn't correlate to what the brain was saying. So That is, I look at that as, gosh, it's one of the joyous complexities of being human, that we are all very, very different. And how you respond to pain, partly it's how you learned to respond to pain. Part of it is just how much you care about whether it hurts or not. What your mood is in that moment. I mean, I always tell the story to my students. You know, when you're running across campus late to class and you stub your toe and you keep going and you get to class and you find out that your sandals are all bloody because you stubbed your toe, you say, what happened? Contrast that to getting up out of bed in the middle of the night and toddling off to the bathroom and stubbing your toe just a tiny bit. And you're in excruciating pain. What's going on there, right? So our sensitivity to pain stimulus varies dramatically throughout the day. Now, the second answer to your question is that, indeed, there are a population of people who are completely insensitive to pain. It's a genetic mutation. It's evident in a population of people living in India. These people are lacking a particular sodium channel in their genome. And it's sodium channel is very, very important for pain. They do not feel pain. They could take a knife, put it through their hand, and take it out and staunch the bleeding. Wouldn't feel it at all. They die young, not surprisingly. But they live long enough to procreate. So this genetic mutation has persisted in the population for a couple hundred years, I think. And scientists are now better using that as a way to better understand how the pain mechanisms are working, and using that as also a tool to understand how they might be able to build better analgesics that might work for some people. But there is no cure for this population of people. They are the way they are.
I know somebody who has a chronic pain issue, and they actually have an implanted electronic device that is supposed to dull that pain. Do you know anything about that? Where in the nervous system is that actually affecting? And how's that related to the studies you're doing?
That's a great question. And this is one of those times that I also share with my students and anybody who's going to either talk to your friends casually or talk in public, you have to be willing to say, I don't know. And when you don't know, you just got to straight up and say, I don't know that. I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. I don't have anywhere near enough knowledge to answer the question intelligently. But I'm also very happy to pull up some information, and I can share that with you in a day or so. Go ahead.
In the last 10 or 15 years, I've discovered that doctors have suddenly acknowledged that one-day-old infants actually can feel pain. And there's been the mythology in medicine that infants don't feel pain. And I know it's convenient not to hire an anesthesiologist and worry about killing a baby, but babies used to have thoracic surgery and lung and heart surgery without anesthesia and circumcision. And like, how did they get away with that? If you can, and where are they now? I think the academics are further ahead in this, but if you can speak to that.
Well, I can't talk about what's done medically because I'm not a medical doctor and I don't know. I will say that the whole notion that infants, and for that matter, animals feeling pain, was not believed. People felt that animals didn't feel pain, that infants didn't feel pain. It actually goes back to the René Descartes. So, you know, I think Descartes did a good job of putting science in a good motion, but like many learned men of the age, they would say things that they think are true and important, and everybody would believe them. And he felt that to be able to articulate that you were in pain, you had to be fully conscious. You had to be self-aware, that you had to have this understanding of who you are in the universe. And that if you didn't have that type of consciousness that you could articulate to other people, that you could not feel pain. So anybody, anything that could not articulate its presence in the universe, he deemed as not able to feel pain. And for the next 500 years, everybody believed it. And up until very, very recently, animals that would go to the vet would not get anesthesia for surgeries. They just tie them down, pull it tight, and go at it as fast as they could. They might numb them a little bit to keep them from wiggling, but people just didn't think that they were feeling pain. Now, some of my scientist colleagues will talk about the data that I showed and say, look, you've got to be a little careful about calling it pain for the rat. That really what you're demonstrating is that there's a hypersensitivity, that I can poke the foot, and I poke the foot, and I poke it a little harder, and it pulls a foot away. Or if it's the nerve is tied, I poke it just a little bit, and it pulls away right away. So it's super sensitive. I agree. And it's super sensitive in a way that's akin to pain. So where do you cross the line between saying it's consciously aware of the pain and the associated discomfort that goes with it, or that there's a hypersensitivity? The way I look at it is if you've got an infant or an animal that is hypersensitive, you should do something to treat that hypersensitivity so that it's more comfortable and can go about its life in a better, healthier way. So it harkens back to Descartes.
You were talking about how it's hard for people to understand medical and science technology and different things that happen to them. So are you thinking about maybe making comic books and that sort of thing for adults that they can better understand the treatments they have to go through and the things that are happening to them?
So the question has to do with how better to communicate, and I would love to do that. The video that we made for the heart transplant kids, I'd love to make a version of that for any transplant patient, because any transplant patient needs to know what we were packaging in that story about why you need to take the medicines, why you need to do these things. And getting that explanation is really valuable. We did a video on osteoporosis. And actually, when we did that study on osteoporosis, we started off by taking a population of about 200 people, I think it was, 190 people, who were already enrolled in a clinical study on osteoporosis. And they'd all gone through informed consent. They'd all seen the doctor. They've all gotten a lot of information on osteoporosis. Some of them had osteoporosis, some of them didn't have osteoporosis, but they all got the same information. So knowing that they got all this information, I said, gosh, I better give them a test to find out how much they know about osteoporosis before I then give them my video to find out how much they can learn by watching the video. I gave them the test, and they stunk. They didn't know anything. They didn't know where you got vitamin D. They didn't know what the DEXA scan was. There's tons of stuff that they should have heard, and I know they did hear, or they were given pamphlets about it, but that they didn't connect with. And I showed those results to the head of the study, and she was aghast that, you know, there was all this information that they'd been giving patients, and it just wasn't getting through. So we actually weren't able to finish that study, so I don't know how much they would have learned from the video. But definitely, without a doubt, how you package information is going to make a huge difference to how well people can comprehend it and then put it to use. And from my perspective, the more you can build it into a story, the better able it is for the people to carry that information. If I just give you a string of facts, you're going to hear the fact. You might remember the fact for a little while. You might be able to tell your friends about it later in the week. But within a few days, it's going to get corrupted. You're going to forget it a little bit, and you're going to muddle it. I tell you a story. I tell you a story about how something works, and you remember the story. The fact is embedded in the story. It's going to stay with that story. And that's how we did it for the last million years. So anytime you can build a story, tell the information in ways that you've got the facts built up throughout the whole story, that is something that people will be able to carry with them a long time. The second level for that I think is really important for us, we're super visual. I mean, heck, we were painting on walls 50,000 years ago that were really hard to get to. I think the more visual you can tell the story, the better it is. And we know that already from how, you know, great TV and movies are. But as a scientist, if I have a visual in there, I want the visual to be scientifically accurate. I want it to carry a story and show all that's going on there. And the way I look at it, if we had taken a walk today in Schenley Park, it was a beautiful day. And we could have walked through, we could have had a pleasant stroll in the woods, we could have seen some plants beginning to sprout up, pushing back the ice. We would have seen all sorts of animals. My kids just the other day saw a mink in Frick Park. Who knew? We would see a couple of little things. but it would be just a pleasant, beautiful day. And the woods are the woods. But if we had grabbed naturalists and take them with us, and they're pointing out all sorts of different things to us, they're changing the experience. They're not changing the woods. All the detail was there the first time. All the detail's there the second time. It's just how you manage that experience. So when I show a visual that's scientifically accurate, I've got all the detail built into that. And I can tell a bunch of different stories. I can show it to a four-year-old and tell them a very casual story. I can show it to a graduate student and say, this is all that you need to know for the test. So to me, it's the narrative, building it into a story. It's giving good pictures of the story. You know, as kids, you loved the books that had stories. You hated the ones that had all the little words, right? You want the pictures. So you want pictures. You want good pictures. You want compelling pictures. You want the color pictures. You want the pictures that look real. And then you got a good message.
I kind of wanted to play off of Ashley's question. I recently got my wisdom teeth out and was given the little booklet of this is what you need to know for your surgery, which I threw to the side because the doctor has done the surgery many times before. I felt like I was in good hands. Do you think part of the ignorance of people is because they're too trusting of professionals?
It's a complex combination of things. Usually the pamphlet, the piece of paper that you get at the doctor's office is written cryptically. I'm trying to be really polite. It's just not accessible. And that's one of the reasons why there's such a challenge. So you read the first sentence to you and say, and it's in the trash. And the tragedy for that is that for a lot of patients, you know, they go to the ER, they got a nasty cut, they get the pamphlet, they go home, and 5 days later they're back in the ER because they didn't read the pamphlet. The pamphlet said change the bandage every day. They didn't change the bandage and they have this whopping infection. And now that ER, a second ER visit is another $10,000 visit. So the problem comes from it all different directions. The physicians and the people who are writing these pamphlets are not doing anywhere near as effective a job as they could and should do it. They write it, they give it to the doctor and say, is this what you want to say? The doctor says, yes, that's what I want to say. And they might give it to somebody else to proofread it and maybe tone it down some of the jargon that's in there, but they don't give it to the patients and say, read this and tell me what you learned. And can you even read it all the way through, front to back? They don't do that. So that's the number one issue. Secondarily, yes, we are trained to believe that these people are gods, that they know what they're doing. We're putting our life in their hands, and we're trusting them with that. And we should, because they've gone to school a lot longer than we have in studying this disease or this condition. But they're people just like you and I. They're husbands and wives and sons and daughters of people. And they went to school and they read the web pages. And you're hoping that they remember everything. So even if they've done the surgery a lot of times, you should never be shy about asking them to slow down and tell you exactly what they're going to do. You should never be shy about saying, look, I know you've done this 1,000 times, but convince me that you're the best person in the world to do this to me today. You can ask them questions. Ask them a lot of questions. Ask them questions until they say, look, you know, we got to go on. Never be shy about asking questions. And if they give you an answer, and you think about the answer, you should be able to understand the answer. And they give you an answer and you say, that doesn't make a darn bit of sense to me. You say, I don't get it. Try again. I need a do-over. Say it a different way. Draw me a picture. Get me somebody else who can answer my question. Don't stop until you're satisfied. Now, the big challenge is, you know, I go to the doctor, I feel like crap, I want to feel better, I'm not really listening. I just want to feel better. If I have something really serious going on, I go to the doctors, I'm really nervous. You know, I'm not paying attention. That's when you really need somebody else to come with you and ask the questions that you're not asking. The way I built the videos, my intention was that we should build a whole industry where we build the video. You come in, you've got a problem, here's your condition, I understand what's going on, here's the medicine you're going to take. I'm not giving you a pamphlet. Here, go home and watch this video. You go home and watch the video. You get Uncle Joe to come over and you say, hey, Joe, watch this video with me. He watches the video. You get, you know, his son-in-law, who's the dentist, to come in. Hey, watch the video. Answer this question for me. You watch the video. You watch it as many times as you want to. And you also create a list of questions based on what you now know from the video. And you go back to the doctor and say, I watched the video. I learned a lot, but here's my questions. Now that I've had a chance to calm down and understand as much as I can from this video about what's going on, here's my questions that I still want to get answered. Then you've got this informed dialogue going on between an informed patient and a doctor who understands the types of questions that you really want to get to. That's the way it should be. Yes? So the question has to do with, why do we hurt when the weather changes? Is that fair? I don't know. And, you know, there's been a fair number of studies that have more or less debunked it, that say that, you know, you feel bad all the time. And you might say you feel worse on a day that's cloudy and rainy and crummy, but it might be that you're feeling worse that day because it's cloudy, rainy, and crummy. And your joints were feeling exactly the same on the sunny and warm day, but you just felt happier, so that it may very well be that. I don't necessarily buy that because, I mean, geez, this last Saturday, I'm looking out the window saying, oh, God, it's snowing again. And I'm trying to get upstairs and my knees are killing me. And I'm saying, Jesus, what's going on with this? So I know exactly what you're talking about. I just don't know the data for it. Well, I guess you're done.
If nobody else is asking, I'll jump in again. I kind of want to go to the second set of stories you were telling about educating. My degree is in education. I've been in a lot of schools. A lot of the projects you're talking about are like museum pieces. What can individual teachers do to improve their classroom daily to try to get these scores up so we're more competitive in a global market?
That's a very complex question. And one of the difficult challenges you put into your question was getting the scores up. We don't really want to teach to the test. We want to teach kids how to think, how to solve problems, how to read really, really well, read deeply, understand the difference between reading a novel and reading a science textbook, and how to extract information from each of those differentially. We really want to teach kids how to write well and put sentences together. On the one hand, I was delighted to hear that the SATs were going back to the 1600 score. I mean, it was even commented on the news that, gosh, now I'll be able to compare my scores to my kids and convince them that I was smarter than them. Maybe, maybe not. But I was sad to hear that they were cutting down and diluting the vocabulary. I mean, you know, that's a shame. We should have a rich vocabulary. We shouldn't dumb that down. So solving the problem of education is super complex, and it goes to many different levels. One area where I 100% agree with President Obama on is we need to teach kids starting at a very, very early age, that working with kids and in preschool and engaging them is going to put them on a track that makes them a better student for the rest of their lives. Now, I wish it were the case that those kids who need it most had an adult caregiver or parent at home who was reading to them multiple times a day, who was taking them to museums multiple times a month, that were taking them out for walks in the woods every single day. A lot of kids don't have that. So that's where you really need to put them into daycare, but you want that daycare for that little child to be really enriching, that really engages the kids in learning their alphabet, learning how to read, working with them so that they build these fundamental skills that's going to help carry them on for the rest of their lives. If a teacher who's teaching second grade has a bunch of kids who already know how to read, who already know their numbers and can do simple addition and subtraction, then he or she can start teaching those kids a lot of other stuff. But if we're in second grade and 80% of the kids can't read yet, she's got to teach them how to read. And she's only going to get them to partway through the first grade reading level, and then they're into third grade. So they're already a couple years behind, so when they get to fourth and fifth grade and they take that standardized test of seeing how well they can read at a fifth grade level, they tank because they didn't have the foundation that put them there in the first place. So putting everybody behind is part of the problem, and that's where we really need to work hard to fix these things so the kids can, when they're in fourth grade, be learning cool science, not learning how to read. That when they're in seventh grade, they can be learning really cool math as opposed to still struggling with addition, subtraction, and multiplication. That we need to build these things up earlier on. I think that's going to help. Waiting for Superman is a really good movie, and it talks in depth and detail about America's educational system and where its strengths and weaknesses lie, and even poses some ideas about how to make some changes in the systems that would become potentially more effective. So.
I have two children who are 11 and 14, and we've been fighting with his very advanced school to get, especially the younger one, adequate instruction in math since first or second grade. And the only thing I really did different was teaching him how to estimate big numbers. Like how many pennies are in my hand, how many cookies are on that rack. Like you should be able to visualize that and do it in preschool. And we read to our kids, preschool, we should be doing numbers, and estimation will track throughout their life if they learn to estimate. So all you grandparents and parents, do this with your youngsters and it'll pay off. It's marvelous.
I agree with that. But what we do is, as parents and grandparents and individuals, is we always work from our strengths. We all can read, and we can all sit down with a child and read, and that's easy and obvious for us. Playing with numbers is a little more abstract for a lot of people, and it's not the first thing that comes to mind. But I agree with you. And it extends beyond that. Look at the birds on the feeder. Well, which bird is the sparrow? Which one's the cardinal? You know, you can start identifying these discrete objects and knowing what their habits are and what they like and what they don't like. The world's a wonderful place. It's a great thing to look at. My pleasure.
And thank you everybody for coming out tonight. We hope to see you next month on April 7th. Drive safely.